Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Australia has launched one of its largest evacuations in history, with more than 200 wildfires burning across that country, warnings of extreme danger. The Victoria State Government, that's the state of Victoria, has ordered as many as 140,000 permanent residents, tens of thousands more vacationers to leave the region before fires close roads and trap them. One person that was spoken to by, I believe it was the Associated Press, said they plan to stay behind. This was what caller Kevin was talking about. In New South Wales, to try to protect her home, even as two of her young sons went off and volunteered as firefighters up the coast.
My youngest son hopefully will come here tomorrow, because tomorrow is D-Day.
D-Day being the day that the fires may, in fact, reach their home. Meanwhile, the Premier of the state of Victoria, Daniel Andrews, defends the state of disaster declaration in East Gippsland, saying it was the right decision.
In those declared areas, in those six local government areas, and the Alpine resorts, and particularly in the fire impact zone, if you can leave, you must leave. That's the only safe thing for you, your family.
Meanwhile, millions of plants and animals also said to have been killed by this historic outbreak of wildfires in Australia. That message from ecologists sounding the alarm. We had reporter Maggie Rooley reporting for the ABC News in New South Wales.
We went to a koala hospital that's taken in dozens of koalas from these fires. And the researchers there told us they've never seen the type of severe injuries on koalas, this type of severe burning. And many of them even told us, you know, the extent of these fires and the extent of the habitat that have been just eradicated for the koalas. They now fear for the koalas' future.
The koalas collectively, not the individual ones. I want to bring an expert onto the show to talk more about wildfires in general, what we can learn from what is happening in Australia. And of course, I don't know about all of you, but my mind has been turning more and more off into our own summer that will be upon us before we know it, as we hope we do not see the sort of damaging wildfires that we have in recent years. John Innes is professor and the dean at UBC's Faculty of Forestry, joins us now for a conversation. Professor, thank you for your time. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Your thoughts on what we are currently seeing in Australia?
It's an absolutely tragic situation. We know that at least 15 people have died, including a volunteer firefighter. As many as 40 or 50 people are missing, possibly more. We know that over 1,000 homes have been lost. Again, it may be more once the smoke clears. People will be able to get full assessments done, and about 5 million hectares of forest have been burnt. So we are really dealing with a terrible situation, and it's no wonder that states of emergency have been declared.
How fast can a wildfire move in an environment such as the one we see in eastern Australia?
It's very much dependent on the wind. But under strong winds, those fires can move extremely fast. They are burning in eucalyptus forests. Eucalyptus contains oil, and that oil is flammable.
Interesting.
So effectively, the forests explode, and that fire can move at huge speeds, far faster than anyone can either run or even drive. And so people can get trapped very, very easily in these forests.
Now, the properties of the eucalyptus plant have not changed substantially, at least in my awareness, in recent history. I haven't really heard about explosive forests and these fires before. What is different this time? Is it climate change?
It's not actually that different to what has happened in the past.
Okay.
We had a very similar situation in early 2009,
mm-hmm.
and then there were a large number of fatalities. Over 200 people died. And essentially what happens is when we have the very dry conditions, which we've got now, combined with wind, these forests become very, very flammable.
Now, what can be done by experts and others in Australia to try to mitigate these harms or even stop these fires before they happen? Because if the eucalyptus plant itself is a factor, they're all over the place, aren't they?
Well, the key is actually managing those forests in a way to reduce their flammability and reduce the chances of a severe burn developing. And what a number of land managers have been calling for some time are controlled burns that reduce the amount of fuel on the ground, the amount of leaves, small fine twigs and other material, so that the forests are less likely to burn intensely as they are at the moment. There will always be fires, but the key is to try and control the intensity of those fires.
I'm glad that you brought up the idea of forest management practices, because that's a matter that we've discussed both here in British Columbia as well. Human beings, we almost have this instinctual programming. We know that fires are dangerous. When they break out, we do everything we can generally to try to stop them from spreading. We've done so to the best of our ability, both here in BC as well as elsewhere in the world. Have we, in fact, though, been causing a problem this whole time because we've been allowing fuel to build up to such a substantial degree that when it does, or when it is ignited by something, we can't deal with the huge infernos?
That's absolutely correct. It is partly as a result of our activities, both in British Columbia and in Australia. We've been very good at preventing fires, but there are some forest types that are actually adapted to having large-scale fires go through them. And their seeds, for example, and lodgepole pine is a good example, but also many eucalypts, they will not open unless they are heated. And that heat comes from a fire.
So, fires are to be expected. They have been put out to some degree by human beings with more and more fuel ending up on the forest floors. Are these infernos inevitable then?
Right now, they are very likely to reoccur. And unless we manage our forests more effectively and control the fuels more effectively and create breaks within the landscape that will actually prevent the fires from spreading, then I'm afraid the fires are inevitable.
What can be done in terms of sheltering communities or making communities more resilient to these wildfires? Because I know we've had situations here in BC with fire breaks erected around various remote communities, about talk of highways and how much brush should be cleared back from them. Like, the thermal energy that comes off one of these infernos is absolutely enormous. It's not like in the movies where as long as the fire doesn't touch you, you're fine. It can kill you and it can set things on fire just with infrared radiation once it gets close enough to you, can't it?
Once it is close enough, yes. The biggest problem with forest fires are what the Australians call ember attacks and what we call spotting, which is where you have a lot of wind associated with the fire front. You have embers that are being lifted up by the wind, and they can be carried several kilometers and dropped. So you have these almost like bombs coming in that are firebombing the forest all around where the fire is occurring. And that makes it really difficult to control once you're in that sort of a situation.
I want to ask you about wildlife. Now, I know it's not necessarily your area of expertise, but when we're talking about the koala, when we're talking about the Australian indigenous wildlife that is there, it would appear that they are not adapted for these sort of fires, or at least that they haven't seen them before. What do you make of that?
Well, obviously, an animal only lives for so many years.
Yeah.
And so an individual animal may not be aware of the danger of a fire. They will instinctively run from it, but they may not be able to run fast enough. I mean, koalas cannot run particularly fast, and you mentioned those earlier.
Yeah.
Kangaroos can move quite fast, but if the landscape is blocked for any reason, then they may be unable to escape. And with these fires, there are multiple fires occurring, and so nobody, no animal knows which way is to run, and no human actually knows which way very often. And that's why people get trapped and die in these fires.
I recall an image that was captured in British Columbia's forest during one of our recent fire seasons. I don't remember the exact year, but it was a herd of wild horses that had died, and it was their charred remains that were being photographed. And I remember just in that moment realizing how fast these fires can move and how powerful they were, because if literal wild horses cannot outrun one of these fires, what hope does any human being have?
Well, that's you're quite right. You have no chance in some of those fires. The fires that we experience tend not to move quite so fast as some of the Australian fires. But once you're in the situation that we're in at the moment in Australia, then there's very little you can do.
I want to take a quick break. Our guest is Professor John Innes. He's professor and dean at the University of British Columbia Faculty of Forestry. I keep seeing these images on our television screens that we have here in the studio of the latest from Australia. We've been hearing reports from Australia, more than 140,000 human beings at this point, subject to various evacuation alerts and orders, 200 wildfires burning. You have the premier of the state of Victoria, Daniel Andrews, defending his state of disaster declaration, saying that it was the right decision. Others saying, no, these are their homes. They choose not to leave. Of course, caution that the fire can move a lot faster than you realize. If you can see it, it might already be too late. Quick break. More after this.
Keeping you informed, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
About 5 million hectares of land said to have been burned, at least 19 people killed, more than 1,400 homes have been destroyed, and what is being called the worst wildfire season on record in Australia. Australia launching one of the largest evacuations in its history, more than 200 fires burning across that country, warnings of extreme danger. Victoria's state government ordering as many as 140,000 permanent residents, tens of thousands more vacationers to leave the region before fires close roads and close them all in. We are, of course, continuing to monitor this situation. Our guest is an expert from the University of British Columbia and how forest fires function. Now, Professor John Innes, you mentioned the eucalyptus trees have some unique ecology that makes them more prone to explosive conflagration, for lack of a better word. So we wouldn't have to worry about that here. I also know somebody who lived for a period of time in Australia who suggested to me that the hardwood nature of many of the trees there might also change the way these fires function relative to our own. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've seen areas that were subject to severe burns in Australia after the 2009 fires. And one of the things that struck me was that while there was, everything was black and there was no foliage, the trees were still there. And within a few months, many of the trees, not all, but many of them were actually resprouting again. So the trees weren't actually killed by the fire. And that just shows that they are adapted to having fires move through the ecosystem. What we did find, though, in some areas, there are certain types of eucalypts that are killed by fire. They don't resprout afterwards. And so some forests are adapted, some forests are much less adapted. So it does vary depending on which type of eucalyptus you're talking about. And remember, there are over 800 species of eucalyptus trees in Australia.
Interesting. I actually had no idea there were that many. Looking forward, what can the people of Australia expect? Will, once these areas are burned out, sort of no longer be a danger, having to resprout, perhaps taking several decades to build up fuel again? How does it work?
Well, that certainly will be the case in some areas. Once you have a major fire that kills off a lot of the vegetation, then it does take time for that area to recover. But very often people don't particularly want to move back into that environment. I mean, it's black, it's lacking vegetation, it looks kind of like a desert almost. In areas where the forest is able to sprout again, and as I said, many eucalypt types are adapted to that, then they will become prone to fire fairly quickly. So it really depends on the situation, it depends on the forest.
All right, 250-386-1161. If you have a question for our expert guest, Mark is on the line. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
A subject that should be loud and clear, publicized everywhere. You've had experts on before. I think Dr. David Anderton. And he reiterated stuff I learned as a plumber in my trip to Yellowstone in 1988, 1990. They talked, you know, the big fire there. Mm-hmm. So all of this forest fire science is knowable, yet seems to be obscured to the policymakers of the last 20 years, who essentially allowed twigs to turn into dynamite. Now we can't do much about it. And yes, I have friends that had livestock up in the interior in the last fire and had to watch their pets burn, yet well, nobody seems to talk about the major contributor is mismanagement. Certainly, climate change exacerbates this whole thing, but it kind of makes no sense to me. We've kind of allowed people to build or pitch a tent at the bottom of a hill with a bunch of loose rocks and then, you know, and say, well, there's nothing we can do about the earthquake. Well, I just shake my head sometimes and go, the real culprit is mismanaged forest. And this is happening in our province. Our heart goes out to our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world, but it seems to be a common thread. The managers that are placed in positions of responsibility, I don't know what they're doing, and it's time for them to be held accountable. We have a recent assistant deputy minister of forest who's been in position You know, ministers come and go, but the ADM, he needs to be asked the question, what about those people who watched their horses burn in your last fire? Nice strategy. Paint yourself in a corner and let us find our way out. I'm pissed off because I got a lot in it. This is absolutely stupid. It's time to blow the whistle.
Mark, thanks for the call. Mark, I'm sure, is not the only citizen out there concerned about forest management practices. Professor Ennis, your thoughts on British Columbia, what has been done versus what should have been done?
Well, we had very severe fires back in 2003, and there was reports came out of that as to what we needed to do to protect our communities. And some of the work has been done, but only about 10% of what is required. And so we desperately need more work done to make our communities fire safe. We also need to make sure that people really understand what the implications are of living in a fire-prone landscape are. We talk about being fire smart. Many people are not fire smart. And we actually sometimes even have community rules that make it really difficult to abide by fire smart guidelines. So making sure that you don't have trees close to your buildings, that you don't put propane tanks right up against your house, and little things like that that can make an individual property safer for fire. We also need to make sure that we have fire smart landscapes so that we can actually isolate some of these fires, we can protect areas, we can ensure that there are barriers to the spread of fires. And we're seeing that done in some places like the national parks in the Rockies, mm-hmm. but we're not seeing it done over the rest of the landscape.
Why not? Too expensive? Not enough people? What's going on?
It's a combination of a number of factors. There is resistance against it. It is expensive. There are concerns over who is actually responsible for implementing that. We do have a program in British Columbia that has been introduced that is supposed to work in this area, but it is limited in terms of its funding, and it basically isn't funded enough.
So when we talk about doing that work, for the benefit of our listener, what would that involve? We've got a lot of fuel on the ground. It seems to me we're not going to shovel it up and take it anywhere. We need to burn it, but we need to burn it in such a way as to not have it spread to the adjacent fuel and cause a firestorm. So how does that actually work?
Absolutely. It is a very fine balancing act, and it is difficult. It requires skilled operators. You need to choose the right time of year to do it. It is expensive. You need to have people come in and clear out some of the very dense stands. That wood either needs to be burnt or sent to people who could actually use it, for example, in biomass plants. We need to take a more integrated approach to how we are managing our forests and how we are doing things like fuel control. There are ways that we could be more efficient, but we're not actually implementing them yet.
Professor John Innes is our guest. If you have a question or a comment, 250-386-1161, *1070, a free call on your wireless device. Chris on my text messages says, good morning, Adam. Years ago, I watched a documentary about Australia. It had an interview with an Aboriginal person commenting on the very poor forest practices brought by European colonists to Australia, saying the original inhabitants of the lands had a system of setting fires and controlling the bush, and at the time, it seemed to work quite well. That knowledge was lost, though. Your thoughts, Professor Innes, on the knowledge that already exists and how it may benefit us all going forward?
That's a really interesting point, and it is one that is subject to a lot of debate within Australia. There are those that feel that the Aboriginal peoples did understand the landscape and do understand the landscape. They had a process known as fire stick farming, where they would actually burn, deliberately burn areas. That is slowly being reintroduced in some parts, such as in the Northern Territory. It has not been reintroduced yet in the coastal areas where we're now seeing these very severe fires occurring.
Okay.
The debate is actually really interesting because if we look at photos, paintings of when the Europeans first arrived, it appears to have been a very different landscape to what we're seeing today.
Yes. Professor John Innes, I want to say thank you very much for your time and your insight helping us to better understand these matters. Is there anything that we haven't touched on in this conversation that you would like our audience to know about? We've got a couple of minutes left.
Well, one of the questions that is always asked is, what's it going to be like this year?
Yes.
Unfortunately, we can't say. We don't know what the weather is going to do between now and the fire season.
Okay.
And we don't know what the weather during the fire season is going to be like. However, the trend is for more and more fires to be occurring, and so we need to be prepared, and we need to be better prepared than we have been.
All right. Professor John Innes, I'm sure we'll speak again in future as we here in British Columbia cast our gaze forward to this summer, crossing our fingers, hoping that the dice of randomness of weather and Mother Nature roll in our favor despite some unfortunate fire seasons in recent years. So thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Take care. Bye now. Bye. Here we go, folks. So that's what's happening in Australia. Not entirely the same in terms of the ecosystem. The eucalyptus plant, of course, having a unique biology compared to anything that we have here. Also, hardwoods. It's interesting to think about that. You know, hardwood itself may be an adaptation by Mother Nature to survive, or at least better survive, fire activity. So I don't want to say that just because of what's happening in Australia right now, we should expect the same sort of problems here in BC. But I think that it is fair and accurate to say that the practice of prohibiting fires and putting them out everywhere we can for many, many decades in many nations, including Canada, including Australia, was always a failed policy because we were delaying the inevitable. Not only were we delaying the inevitable, we were making sure that when it finally did find a way to happen, it would be so much worse than what we were avoiding in the first place. It's almost like we were running up debt, borrowing money that we had interest collecting on it, and we thought we could do it forever. But no, it turns out that Mother Nature has other tricks up her sleeve, so to speak. And debt collector comes one day after all, and it's the situation that all of us are in right now. So we'll watch that one very closely. All right, we are going to take a quick break. We'll get the latest from the newsroom. And we're going to chat with an analyst from Stats Canada. Taylor Mitchell will be joining us. Taking a look back at the last decade as we moved out of the, what are we calling it, the 2010s? The 2010s? It doesn't sound right. Anyway, the decade ended. What happened with the prices in your budget? We'll take a mile-high look at it in just a moment. Stay with us.